Alex MacDonald was born in Regina, attended Holy Rosary School and Campion College to grade 12, graduated with a BA and MA from the University of Saskatchewan, Regina campus. He studied at King's College of the University of London, England, where he got his PhD. From 1974 to 1980, Alex worked in Saskatoon as secretary to the Saskatchewan University's Commission. He joined the English department of Campion College of the University of Regina in 1980, where he is currently associate professor of English. Alex has many, many publications, and Alex, I'm not even going to start because otherwise there'll be no time for your presentation. Alex is married to Catherine Arthur MacDonald, who retired in 2013 from the Regina Board of Education. They have two sons, James and Colin, and it really is not welcome, but welcome back.
Well, I'm very pleased to be here again, and to talk a little bit about a subject that is connected with the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, in remembrance of those who fought and died to defend us, even though most of us were not born yet. I know I wasn't. This talk was read for me originally by my brother in the University of Regina series that's currently still going on about World War I, the centenary of the start of the war last February, and then I was asked to come and talk today. So I'm not just going to read the talk as my brother did at the more formal lecture series, but I'm just going to go through the slides and make a few points about them. One of the things that I've done for preparation for today is to think about where I might take this talk as I develop it. There's going to be some kind of a publication coming out of the lecture series, and the talks that were given will be increased to about 8,000 words from what they currently are, which is more like 2,000 words. And since it's always a good thing for academics to get things published, I will certainly try to do that, although there's no guarantee that mine will be selected. So, where's the arrows here? Okay. I'll start off with a bit of a timeline, and one of the main points I started with is from my background teaching literature, and particular literature of the Victorian period. I don't teach so much in the modernist period, but in the early 20th century, if you read the anthologies, one of the words that appears over and over and over again is the word fragmentation. The idea that at the end of the Victorian period, due to a whole range of circumstances, there was a fragmentation of not only many particular issues, but in sort of general, the whole cultural fragmentation. And one of the ways that that's expressed, it's a sort of breakdown of what they called master narratives. So while the Victorians believed in certain fixed ideas about religion, about empire, the British Empire, about the way politics should be conducted, about the relationships between the genders, between men and women, many of those narratives which people had in their heads began to be challenged, to be fragmented. There was a group of thinkers called the Futurists. You may know of them in Italy, beginning in Italy, and they mounted a big challenge to the existing cultural stereotypes. In its most extreme form, Futurism talked about bulldozing all of the art galleries and the museums and getting rid of all that old cultural junk and starting new, you know, kind of wiping the slate clean. And what they wanted to build was big, tall, concrete, technical, modern stuff, as opposed to all of that old stuff. Now, World War I became sort of the dominant symbol of this cultural fragmentation and this idea that we had come to a kind of a historical watershed and that everything that happened after this was going to be different. One of the ways that one metaphor for it is sort of the geological, the idea of a tectonic plate shift in underneath the Earth's surface, which kind of changed everything. Now, the particular topic I'm going to talk about today, imagism, is a poetic movement which was part of this whole cultural change, a small part, but an important part in literary terms. And it represented a rebellion against Victorian poetic ideas. And there's a little timeline here which begins with the Romantic period. And is that focused? It is. It's all right. Okay. It begins with the Romantics, and then mentions the Pre-Raphaelites and the Imagists, and all three of those were radical or rebellious movements against the pre-existing ideas about what literature should be. In the case of the Imagists, there was a rebellion against Victorian poetry, against sort of the cultural dominance of people like Tennyson, for example. And one of the kinds of poetry that the Victorians liked to write were very long poems. So you had famous poems like In Memoriam by Alfred Lord Tennyson, or Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and there were quite a number of other very long poems, and the Imagists believed that they should be writing poetry that was very, very tiny, miniature poems of very much like the Japanese haiku form of poetry. Now, this whole notion that poems should be only two lines or three lines suggests, by its very nature, fragmentation, the idea of you could no longer have an overview of anything or a grand historical sweep, but all you could see were these tiny little fragments of reality that were expressed in the poetry. And my argument here is that, yes, that's obviously true, I wouldn't dispute that, but I'm also suggesting that if you look at some of these fragments, you can also discern much longing for a reintegration and a finding of wholeness again. I'm going to start with T.E. Hume, one of the most prominent of the Imagist poets. He was sent to Cambridge to study mathematics. This picture, taken in 1912, shows him as a young fellow. He preferred to study philosophy rather than the mathematics that he was slated to study. And he came from Staffordshire, and apparently his father said to him, "What's the use of that, philosophy? There is no use at all in Staffordshire." He nevertheless pursued his philosophy. He left Cambridge and was registered at the University of London, studying physics and biology. But he didn't really attend any courses. He went back to Cambridge and was auditing philosophy lectures. One of the stories about him is that he loved to talk, and one of his contemporaries said he could argue the hind leg off a dog. One of his fellow students said he talked great sense, sometimes great nonsense. When it was nonsense, he was fully aware of the fact, but not all his listeners were. He didn't finish school, but in July of 1906, he said he'd rather live on bread and cheese than join the civil service, which was kind of one of the normal career paths. And he decided he would go and see the world, and so he took passage on a cargo boat to Montreal. And he spent some time in Toronto, but also some time on the Canadian prairies. And this time on the Canadian prairies was critical for his development. And one of the statements he made later in his lecture on modern poetry, which is in this book, one of the statements he made was, "The first time I ever felt the necessity or the inevitableness of verse was in the desire to reproduce the peculiar quality of feeling which is induced by the flat spaces and wide horizons of the virgin prairie of Western Canada." So by that time, of course, the Virgin Prairie was really not so virgin because there had been European settlers coming in and disturbing it with agriculture for 30, 40 years by then. Anyway, he returned to England and he began to meet with other poets at a Soho restaurant called the Eiffel Tower. And one of those poets was Ezra Pound, the famous American poet. And it was Pound who coined the term imagism and who wrote a manifesto expressing these poetic ideas. This is Hume's Autumn, which in collections of Images poetry is often anthologized as a leading example. A touch of cold in the autumn night, I walked abroad and saw the ruddy moon lean over a hedge like a red-faced farmer. I did not stop to speak, but nodded, and round about were the wistful stars with white faces like town children. So the moon is personified as kind of a familiar romantic strategy, but he doesn't stop to speak to the moon because he knows that this is a kind of subjective fantasy of his and not a reality. Line 5 seems to sum up the sequence of actions because there are two verbs in it. I did not stop to speak, but nodded. But in fact, both of these verbs describe a single moment, like the sides of a coin or the symbol for yin and yang. And what he's expressing, I think, is the ancient philosophical idea which Plato describes in many different ways, the binary tension between sequency and simultaneity, or what Plato called being and becoming, the idea that one dimension of the reality we experience is a stillness, a permanence, a stasis, and the other is that life is transitory, moving, changing. Everything is always changing. And so this, he expresses this in a kind of concrete image, and he doesn't use any metaphysical language. So he's expressing his interest in philosophy without actually using metaphysical terminology and so on. Ezra Pound called this the ideogrammatic method, and he used the example of the Chinese character for East. And there was a lot of Asian influence and haiku poetry being one of them. But Pound talked about the Chinese, traditional Chinese character for East, which is made up of a symbol for a tree and then a symbol for the sun, and the idea that the sun was entangled in the branches of a tree, suggesting the sunrise in the East. Hume published only 6 poems in his lifetime, not a huge output, and many of the short pieces in later editions of his work are what he called fragments. He called them himself fragments in his notebook. Ezra Pound made a comment that this brevity was a good example to Hume's contemporary poets, he said, who have published many more poems but have less to say than Hume. This one is drawn from his Canadian travels. Somewhere the gods, the blanket makers in the prairie of cold, sleep in their blankets. And there's a couple of others on the next slide here, which were cited by a recent editor of Hume's work as masterpieces. The flounced edge of a skirt recoiling like waves off a cliff. Old houses were scaffolding once, and workmen whistling. So there again you can see the house as a kind of permanent, solid object being there, but the process of building the house and the whistling workmen is the transitory part, the moving part. So he again expresses this complex philosophical idea in language which is totally concrete. Here's a picture of Hume in uniform. He enlisted as a private in 1914. He was wounded in April of 1915 and was sent home to recuperate. And according to Ezra Pound again, who visited him in his army hospital, he was reading to amuse himself or to, you know, pass the time. He was reading the philosophers Kant and Hegel in the original German, and Pound said, "And the hospital staff didn't like it." The trenches at Saint-Éloi, Ezra Pound kind of recorded this poem from conversing with Hume in the hospital. And it's a war poem. Over the flat slopes of Saint-Éloi, a wide wall of sandbags, night. In the silence, desultory men pottering over small fires, cleaning their mess tins. To and fro from the lines, men walk as on Piccadilly, making paths in the dark, through scattered dead horses over a dead Belgian's belly. The Germans have rockets, the English have no rockets. Behind the line, cannon hidden, lying back miles. Beyond the line, chaos. My mind is a corridor. The minds about me are corridors. Nothing suggests itself. There is nothing to do but keep on. Now, if you look at that concluding simile about my mind is a corridor, you also have the same idea incorporated there, in the sense that he's trapped in this place. He can't go anywhere. There's nothing to do. It's a complete being, and yet a corridor, by its very definition, by its nature, suggests going somewhere. So you have those two ideas collapsed into a physical image. In 1916, Hume was commissioned in the Royal Marines Artillery, and then he was killed in some shelling in September of 1917. Here is certainly one of the most famous poems of the Imagist movement, by Ezra Pound himself. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. So Pound actually wrote a description later of how he came to write this poem, coming into a metro station, La Concorde in Paris, and seeing a whole lot of faces which he thought were beautiful. So he went home and he wrote a poem of 30 lines. And then he says a few months later, he cut that down to 15 lines. And then later on, it took its final form, which is this, of 2 lines. Here's a picture of the Art Nouveau type of metro station. One of the definitions of Imagist poetry then obviously is brevity, and saying something in the space of, Pound wrote a single image in his manifesto, but actually in this poem there are 2 images because he's got 2 images conflated, the faces in the crowd superimposed on the picture of petals on a bough. You could say that the search for wholeness is in the metaphor which links the human world, the faces in the crowd, with the image of nature, because that was one of the fragmentations that occurred at the time with the huge influx of people into cities, which had been going on all through the Industrial Revolution, and the sense that people were no longer attached to the natural world and to nature the way many felt they should be. And of course, that's something that we still are struggling with in our big modern cities. This was I had a little bit in the talk, which was just a personal digression. This was not one of the Imagists, but this guy was a contemporary of the Imagists. It's my grandfather, who served in the 1st Canadian Tank Corps. And it occurred to me, I did a little research, and I was reading a book by a British officer who served in the World War I Tank Corps, and one of the things he described was riding along in this tank, and you could only see the world out of this tiny slit at the front of the tank. And I thought, well, boy, that's really a good image of fragmentation, if ever there was one, not being able to see where you're going. And then he also at one point described how the driver of the tank was so frustrated because he couldn't see anything out the slit that he put his ear up to the slit because he thought he might be able to hear where he was going. At least. Another of the Imagist poets was Hilda Doolittle, who came from Pennsylvania, and this poem dated 1915. illustrates, among other things, the difficulty of interpreting these very brief symbolic poems. Are you alive? I touch you. You quiver like a sea fish. I cover you with my net. What are you, banded one? So one of the questions, is she talking about an actual fish here, or is she talking about a person, or is she talking about capturing an idea, or what is it that she's really talking about? If you go back a little bit, one of the most famous Victorian critics was Walter Pater, who did his famous book on the Renaissance, and he suggested that literature should try to approach the condition of music. In other words, it should be pure experience of words rather than any kind of moral or message or meaning that you can paraphrase out of it. Some poets have taken this very literally and have created what is called sound poetry, poetry that consists only of sounds, and you get your experience of the poem through whatever series of sounds. But the Images poems don't go to this extreme, but it's still difficult to say what a particular poem might mean. And this was quite different from the Victorians, too. I had this actually my brother did this illustration of Professor Albert Bierstein to make a little joke about the interpretation of poetry. One of the things as an English teacher and if you have taught English, you probably have heard this too, students will say, well, this is what I get from it, so why can't that be just as right as what you get from it? In other words, it's my opinion, and why not? And then the professor will always say, ah, but you've got to have your evidence from the text. And that's always the answer to it. But then, you know, if you look at these Images poems and you say, well, if the text itself is so ambiguous and so difficult to interpret, how can you actually have evidence from the text? So there is a kind of tension in that is kind of impossible to resolve. There's a picture of H.D. After World War II, she lived most of her life in Europe. After World War II, she published several books on the theme of war, but in World War I, she was an Imagist poet. And here's one of her most famous and most anthologized poems, a kind of invocation to the sea. And it's, whirl up sea, whirl your pointed pines, splash your great pines on our rocks, hurl your green over us, cover us with your pools of fur. I think this suggests two kinds of wholeness, which is an identity between the sea and the land, and then secondly, an identity between the natural worlds and the human worlds. Now, how am I doing for time? Do I have a few more minutes? Yeah? Okay. So I'll go on to... pardon?
But where is she from?
Oh, she was from Pennsylvania, but she lived most of her life in Europe. And one of the reasons perhaps she lived in Europe is she married this guy, Richard Aldington, who is British. And she married him in 1913, and he was one of the founding members of Imagism as well. He did editorial work on these publications, The Egoist and Blast, which were periodicals of modernist literature. In other words, they were like the Pre-Raphaelites, who published their kind of manifesto of their painting and poetry, or like the Romantics, like Wordsworth and Coleridge, publishing the preface to the lyrical ballads. These were statements, in a sense, of what the new modern literature should do, which was different from the old-fashioned Victorian literature, which they thought was history. So the Egoist said it recognized no taboos, for example, and they published parts of Joyce's Ulysses, which, of course, became quite controversial later on. Blast was a magazine of a movement called Vorticism, and it also reflected this new idea. It was edited by Wyndham Lewis. And if you know the paintings of Wyndham Lewis, very, very abstract modernist paintings of sharp lines and a whole bunch of fragments, like maybe a stained glass window or something, that's all broken up into just color but no picture. So here's a poem by Richard Aldington. Aldington was described as an angry young man, and he was, even when he died, the obituary has suggested he was also an angry old man. But this particular poem is more in the comic vein. The chimneys, rank on rank, cut the clear sky. The moon, with a rag of gauze about her loins, poses among them, an awkward Venus, and here I am looking wantonly at her over the kitchen sink. So, poetic device of the humdrum every day, doing the dishes, and the beauty of the night sky. But again, the idea of nature and the human world in some kind of connection. Here's a picture of Aldington in uniform when he enlisted in the infantry in 1916. Now, he returned home with a bad case of shell shock, which affected his life for years. Here, the next two poems are based on his war experiences. The first one is called Living Sepulchres. One frosty night, when the guns were still, I leaned against the trench, making for myself hokku of the moon and flowers and of the snow. But the ghostly scurrying of huge rats, swollen with feeding upon men's flesh, filled me with shrinking dread. So the first part, to me, expresses a wish for stillness, which I think is equivalent to the state of being, a wish for unity with the natural world, a wish for beauty. But then that's contrasted with the scurrying of the rats, which is the movement, the motion, and the images of alienation from nature, from this rather unpleasant side of nature. Insouciance. In and out of the dreary trenches, trudging cheerily under the stars, I make for myself little poems, delicate as a flock of doves. They fly away like white-winged doves. A little bit more cheerful poem, which suggests that the making of works of art is in some way for us humans a method of transcending the experience of division and fragmentation. And so I can't imagine anything more dividing and fragmenting than being in one of the trenches of World War I. Imagism in relation to the wider cultural movement of the time. Albert Einstein's theory of relativity was published in 1915, and of course, in scientific terms, this was one of the challenges to master narratives, that there was a kind of fixed objective reality that could be studied and worked out, and the theory of relativity suggested, no, it depends where you're standing and all of that. So this idea of the importance of the subjective observer in any description of reality was expressed in the modernist period in their narrative idea of stream of consciousness, which I'm sure you have heard of before. The idea that a writer does not write a narrative with certain big blocks of narrative incident, but simply goes into the mind of a character and allows the character thoughts to, you know, meander wherever they will. There are many important modernist works which demonstrate this stream of consciousness, and if you think of Leopold Bloom in Ulysses and his wandering around Dublin, and one of the things, if you look at his dialogue, at his thoughts, you find many incomplete sentences, many sentence fragments, and in a sense this also represents the, you know, at the level of language, this notion of fragmentation. T.S. Eliot's Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock begins with what could almost be called an imagist poem. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky like a patient etherized upon a table. strange image, and also an image of the human and the natural world, but one which is very disturbing because it obviously suggests that all is not well. So I'm coming closer to the end here, so just a few more minutes. Virginia Woolf wrote a famous short story called The Mark on the Wall, which is often anthologized and which you may have seen, but it's an example of the stream of consciousness. Basically, a woman is sitting in a chair and her husband is over there reading something, and this whole story is simply her stream of consciousness, her thoughts, and she looks at a mark on the wall. That's what the story's called, The Mark on the Wall, and she decides it must be a nail. And that nail leads her to think, well, who put the nail in there, and what picture did it have? And so she starts to think of, well, what was in that picture, and then what would Shakespeare have said about this? And so she just goes from one thing to another and covers a whole range of subjects which kind of challenge a lot of Victorian ideas. Towards the end of the story, her husband gets up and he's going to go out and buy a newspaper, and then he says before he leaves, "Nothing ever happens. Curse this war. God damn this war. All the same, I don't see why we should have a snail on our wall." So perhaps this is too much to call it a one-word imagist poem, but in a sense you can see that the human, the technical, the nail, the human-made artifact is now incorporated into the natural, the snail, and united with nature. So I thought that was kind of neat. Here's a book by Helen Carr, 2013 collection of essays, which suggests that the imagist poem was an attempt to make the complexities of modern life cohere. Here's the symbol. So, just by way of concluding, a couple more thoughts about where I might go with this project in the future. I would hope to develop this talk both in terms of depth and in breadth. So in breadth, to consider a number of modernist novels, for example, like Ulysses and so on, in their use of imagist fragments to express their characters' perceptions, things like, in addition to Ulysses, Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, or Antiquée by Aldous Huxley. So I'd take it in that direction. And then secondly, to explore this more in depth, to ask some questions about imagist poetry and imagist theory. And as an example, Ezra Pound's comment that imagist poetry is analogous to the Chinese character for East. There's a nice video on YouTube by a Chinese speaker which explains how the symbols for tree and sun are put together, sun in the branches of the trees. But I looked at a number of these sites and I couldn't find an explanation of why it could not also mean sunset as well as sunrise. And maybe that's just a cultural thing, but anyway, that's an example of one of the many questions that would appear as question marks for the future. Anyway, thank you very much, and I'm apologize if I have gone on too long, but I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Shall we take about 5 minutes for some questions? Comments? Oh, guess who?
Yes.
He did put his hand up first, so...
Thank you for the talk. Just wondering, have you ever thought of like making a connection between the imagist and the rap movement?
And the rap movement?
Yes.
No, I haven't actually. That's a very interesting point. Rap often includes a lot of words and a lot of images in one poem, but probably you could look at pieces of rap poems. One thing I did think about when I was coming yesterday was comparing Images poems to the poem that Helen read, which was the In Flanders Fields by John McCrae. And In that case, it's a beautiful poem, but it's in what they call a fixed form, the rondeau, and it also has a rhyme scheme, and so it represents that more the traditional older form than the new form. And one of the things about rap music is because it moves to such a regular beat, and because it has often a very fixed rhyme scheme, in rhyming couplets, the imagists like Pound, for example, would say they wouldn't want to write in something that has a kind of preset form, because they want the form of the poem to kind of come out of the idea of the poem and grow like something more organic, more natural.
I just wanted to ask a question about where the word fragmentation. Did you say it started to appear kind of everywhere, or was that mostly in the literary world? At the very beginning of your talk.
At the very beginning, no. When I said that, in the anthologies and the histories, the literary histories of the modernist literature appearing around the time of World War I, that word fragmentation, or synonyms like breakup and so on, appear over and over again in those descriptions of what was going on in the literature. And then you know, you can find it in the literature itself too.
Well, thank you very much, Alex. It's
thank you.
A pleasure having you back again.
Thank you very much.